This is the RBJ Bizcast, the weekly podcast of the Rochester Business Journal, a weekly publication of Bridge Tower Media. Visit us online at rbj.net and check out our sister publication, the New York Daily Record, at nydailyrecord.com. Look for us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at RBJ Daily and at NY Daily Record. You can send questions, comments, and suggestions to blouden@bridgetowermedia.com. That's B-L-O-U-D-O-N at bridgetowermedia.com. And now, this week's RBJ Bizcast.
Well, I'm Bennett Loudon, and I'm a reporter at the Rochester Business Journal and the Daily Record, and I'm here with Judge Craig Doran, the administrative judge for the 7th Judicial District. I want to say hi. Go ahead.
Hello, everybody. Hello. Glad to be with you. Ben, thanks for giving me this opportunity.
You're welcome. The reason I wanted to talk to you was I want to talk about the reforms that are coming down the pike in January, some of which are sort of already happening in a way because it's my understanding that because of the bail reform, there's a lot of people who are in jail now who wouldn't have any bail set for them if they were charged with the same thing, you know, when the new laws take effect.
Right.
So a lot of people are going to be let out of jail as a consequence of that, and possibly even before the beginning of the year. Is that correct?
So, you know, we start with the premise that the law takes effect on January 1st. It would be problematic for the sheriffs of each of our counties who administer the jails to have everybody's bail status changed on midnight, January 1st, 2020. So as the court administrator who has the ultimate responsibility of making sure that we implement these things in a sensible way that works best for the people that we all serve and also works best for our partners in the business, so to speak, we try to communicate ahead of time so that we don't overburden any particular component of the process. So we've been engaged in a lengthy process for months now, talking with all of the stakeholders in the business of implementing these reforms, talk about how we can help alleviate what otherwise might be a significant burden. So, for example, I've asked in every county that I supervise, which is the 8 counties in this region, that they convene a group of stakeholders and answer several questions that need to be answered in the implementation of this. One of those questions is, how will you implement the changes in bail? We've given them some suggestions as to what they might want to do, and specifically in the question you ask, what we have suggested is that every judge at every level of court that has a criminal caseload, that has pending criminal cases in which they have a defendant who has either been the subject of bail being set or is actually remanded to the jail or they're in jail and they expect that they will be on January 1st, to have those judges review those cases with the attorneys involved and make a determination applying the new law far enough in advance of January 1st so that there's not a rush of these cases. Mm-hmm. So we've asked, I'll give you an example, just came from a meeting with my staff that helps me oversee the town and village courts. We've asked every town and village judge to review their inventory of cases by a certain date. We've given them a deadline. Most of those deadlines are somewhere around the middle part of December.
Okay.
We've said, make sure you look at every one of your pending cases and review the bail status of those defendants that have been the subject of a bail determination and change their bail status so that it complies with the new law. If that involves releasing somebody, this gives us an opportunity to actually put in place meaningful conditions, perhaps look at some treatment options if there's a substance abuse issue. It allows us the luxury of being able to plan rather than have everybody getting out all at once. Then we've said that we'll have a county-level judge after that deadline go back and make sure that all of the defendants who are in jail have been appropriately addressed so that we can make sure that every single defendant, when the deadline comes, has had the opportunity to have their bail status reviewed. Because as you correctly point out, as of midnight, 12:01 a.m. on January 1st, the law applies. So we cannot have somebody in jail or the subject of a bail determination under the old law as of 12:01 a.m.
Just to back up a little bit and explain to listeners and explain to me a little bit, too, that what we're talking about here is reforms that include, and as far as I'm concerned, two main things, and that is the bail reform you're referring to. And that means that anybody charged with most misdemeanors and nonviolent felonies cannot be held in a jail. They're released and they're under some conditions in some cases, and the judge has some leeway, so to speak. But by and large, nonviolent felonies and misdemeanors, those defendants will be released on an appearance ticket, basically.
Right.
And then the other big part of the reform is basically the speedy trial reforms or the discovery reforms that are going to require the prosecution to provide all their evidence to the defense within 15 days. And I didn't want to try to do all this at once. That's why I want to break it down and talk about the bail a little bit first. So why was there? I know you can't speak for the lawmakers, the legislature who actually made the change, but
that's my old job.
what's the sort of reasoning behind changing, eliminating bail the way they did?
I think if you look at the stated legislative intent and the comments that were made by legislators during the debate, you can glean from all of that that the intent was that folks who are charged with nonviolent matters, some of them charged with crimes that relate to failure to pay a fine, things of that nature, that those folks should be able to avail themselves of alternatives to incarceration, and they shouldn't be occupying a jail cell if it's a low-level crime, if it's a nonviolent crime, and that we should be utilizing the jail space for the folks that need to be in jail for public safety reasons or otherwise. That's not my opinion. You've asked me to speculate about what the intent was, and I can glean, just like anybody else can, from the documents that are public, what the stated intent of the law was. It's to have people who are not the subject of a violent charge not be occupying a jail cell, essentially.
Now, but a lot of prosecutors, I read a story, I think it was the New York Post, according to a lot of prosecutors, these changes are coming down too fast, and they also, as far as the discovery reform goes, they don't really have the resources to make that happen as fast as they are going to have to. That the lawmakers sort of pushed it through without including them in the process and giving them the resources to deal with it and so forth. And I'm not going to ask you to form an opinion on that, I know, of course, but in terms of any, well, for example, in the discovery issue, there's sort of like limits on how fast you can do some things. How are the prosecutors going to be able to comply with providing some of these forensic tests and that sort of thing, and gathering up all the documents that are related to a case? When you think about it, in some cases, it could be third or fourth parties that have stuff that's relevant to the defense.
Right.
How is it possible to actually comply with a 15-day rule?
So, and that's a question that really has to be asked first of the prosecutors themselves. And, of course, in my role as the administrative judge in this region, I've had conversations with many prosecutors, many defense attorneys. I can tell you that in our region, there is a great spirit of cooperation among counsel. I've sat in, for example, in Monroe County, many, many conversations between Sandra Dorley, our district attorney, and Tim Donaher, who's the public defender. And there's a lot of collaboration happening there. There's a lot of reason being injected into the process. The overwhelming majority of these cases will not be the cases you're talking about, where there are complex issues that take much longer to provide the discovery. I don't want to get into percentages, but I think it's safe to say that way more than half the cases we're talking about, probably north of 75% of the whole universe of criminal cases, will be cases where it's actually of benefit to have early discovery, where that will lead to an earlier disposition of the case, a conversation among the attorneys and the court as to how we can process this case, get a quick disposition, a quick resolution, mm-hmm. rather than have it linger for months on end. Now you take the other cases that are left, which are the more complex ones, the ones that involve forensic evidence, the ones that involve a lot of tests, chemical tests, et cetera. They will take longer, and the law does have built into it, and I don't say this as a means of saying that the district attorney's job is easy, because they do have challenges with this new law, but the law does have built into it opportunities for the district attorney to have an extension of the initial period.
The judges do have discretion to do that.
And the judges have, well, they don't. The prosecution doesn't even need to make an application to get an extra 30 days on top of the 15 if the discovery is voluminous or otherwise problematic. The other option that prosecutors have in some of the provisions with discovery is they can ask the court for a protective order. If they believe there's a certain item of discovery that for some reason should not be provided at the very early stages to the defense, they can try to make that case to the presiding judge, and the judge can make a ruling that that discovery doesn't come in the initial phase.
So even if both sides are cooperative, the law says that the information has to be provided within, well, at least 30 days, I guess you'd say, technically, in some circumstances. Even if the defense is willing to, work with the prosecution, that law still needs to be abided by in order to protect them against appeals and things like that, right?
Well, you know, it's. I don't mean to say that it's not cumbersome.
Yeah.
What I mean to say is, the legislature has adopted this. The governor signed it. It's up to us in the judicial branch and the other branches of government to implement the law and to do the best we can to take what has been given us by the legislature and the governor and make it work, make it make sense for the people that we all serve. And that's what we're doing. And I believe, as I have with many other laws that have been passed our way, we've had a lot of them this year, that you can accomplish a great deal with collaboration, communication, working out protocols and policies among all of the parties in a criminal action to try to navigate through all of this. Many of the issues that would otherwise exist can be resolved with some good, healthy creativity and collaboration.
Now, what are the sort of exceptions to the cases where bail can be set or conditions? You talked about people who may be, where their charges are pending, basically, and they might be in jail now, as a matter of fact, and you want all the judges to review those cases. And I mean, what's there to review? If the law says they're to be freed, if it's a particular type of offense, then is there still a judge? Can a judge still impose a condition on the bail?
Sure. The conditions, the law is clear that the conditions have to be the least restrictive necessary to assure the objectives of bail, which are essentially the defendant's return to court. So if, for example, travel restrictions would be deemed the least restrictive condition to assure that a defendant remains within the jurisdiction, then in many cases it would be reasonable for a judge, once you make the determination that that's necessary, to impose as one of the conditions of release that the defendant not leave a certain geographic area or not leave without the judge's permission. So there are a number of options available to, other than incarceration, to facilitate the defendant's return to court, and that's what this law encourages us to look to.
Can a judge use electronic home monitoring, for example?
In some categories of cases, electronic home monitoring, and the statute does clearly set forth the criteria that has to be applied, and the case types that electronic home monitoring is available, the short answer to your question is yes. That can be a tool that judges can use to, again, assure that the defendant will return to court.
Okay, so there's the bail reform and the speedy trial. This is just part of a sort of a plethora of reforms that are coming down, either implemented already or sort of In the planning stages, so to speak. Janet DeFiore, the Chief Justice or the Chief Judge of the state, wants to reorganize the entire system, basically, mm-hmm. and get rid of all these multi-level different courts, like county courts and state Supreme Court can both handle the same types of cases most of the time.
Yep.
And, but at the same time, well, I guess first of all, I guess, can you explain that? Or can you describe that for people who, you know, about what is being proposed?
And, sure. And, so the simplest way to discuss this is to refer to it as the chief judge has, which is court simplification.
Okay.
The chief judge has unveiled a proposal, which I wholeheartedly support, having been in government for most of my professional career, having been a judge for nearly 20 years. The current structure of our court system is in many respects dysfunctional just based upon its complexity. I recently wrote an op-ed piece, which I believe you helped publish, which described what I'm talking about. If you have a matrimonial matter, for example, it's possible that pieces of that case, child custody could be in one place. Let's say there's a collateral, maybe criminal matter that arose because you have a domestic violence situation. Mm-hmm. That could be in a criminal court. And the child custody piece of it could be in family court, and the divorce itself, property issues, division of property would be in state Supreme Court. So it's possible, not even possible, but probable that in many instances you have to show up on three different days in three different places for the same matter.
And in some cases you'll get a court-appointed lawyer, in other places you won't.
Correct. You know, it really is dysfunctional. It's not customer-oriented. It's overly complex, and it's archaic, and really it is the most archaic in the nation. And this chief judge, and I applaud her for it, is focusing on excellence in the courts. And her focus really is, let's step back for a moment and look at things from the customer's vantage point. How are we treating the people that need access to the court system? And are we throwing up roadblocks unnecessarily? And she's identified the structure of our court system as being one of those roadblocks. So it would be a constitutional amendment, so it has to pass two successive sessions of the legislature, and then there would be a statewide referendum. Mm-hmm. And to put it simply, it would take what are now 11 different trial-level courts in the state of New York and combine them all into one state Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. But even without having to enact that legislation and change the state constitution, there's still a heck of a lot of sort of changes going on in the court system. Okay. I've been covering the legal community in courts in the Rochester area for a few years, and just in this amount of time, I've learned a lot about the court system, in particular the creation of these sort of problem-solving courts, mm-hmm. these diversion courts.
Yep.
And you just announced the expansion of the Rochester Human Trafficking Court.
Intervention Court.
Intervention
yep.
Court.
Yep.
That's going to not only handle cases in Rochester, but the region, basically. And there's already some similar programs in Syracuse and Buffalo. Is this the direction we're going in, that we're basically this is sort of a way to do somewhat what the chief judge wants to do, to simplify the system and do it more efficiently without having to enact a lot of legislation? I mean, it might formalize things, you know, if her proposal is adopted. But in the time being, it seems as though things are being realigned and readjusted and being, you know, and a lot of efficiencies are being put into the system so that it's a little bit, everybody seems to be segmented now more so
right,
than before.
Right. Yeah, right. You know, it over time, and I think this is a governmental principle, an organizational management principle, that organizations will over time morph themselves into a very segmented structure. I think it's human nature, it's the nature of our government structure, so to speak. And every so often, there needs to be a leader that comes in and says, you know, we've gotten way down the path of ridiculousness here. It's time to make things a little bit more sensible, common sense. Let's look at restructuring. So I think that's the impetus of the chief judge's plan, but it will not detract from it. Instead, it will enhance what we've done, I think, very well in Rochester and this region, utilizing the courts. Because this is a place where, I've said it before, the court system is really the trauma center of society's ills. We don't treat people's physical health here. We don't treat their mental health here. But the problems in society manifest themselves most clearly in the courthouse. This is where people end up. This is where cases end up. This is where society's issues land. They land in our courts. That makes it our job to do more than just move the cases, do more than just move the paper across the desk, move the defendant in and out of the court, move the litigants in and out of the court. We need to use the opportunity that we have and the influence that we have over not only the individuals that are here, but also the other agencies we work with, to use that influence to try to improve, first of all, the lives of the people that are appearing in front of us, but collaterally, the community. The community benefits immensely from these treatment courts that we do so well in this neck of the woods.
Yeah, you can see what you're talking about by, you know, looking at the different parts, the Veterans Court, the Human Trafficking Court, the opioid courts, and so forth. It makes me kind of wonder whether, I don't know if you can talk about this at all or not, but is there another, every time there's a big issue, like you just said, that comes along, like homeless veterans or veterans in general dealing with the aftermath of their service,
right,
and recognizing that in the courtroom and not just throwing them in jail, but trying to get them help,
right,
and so forth. Anything else, any other category of case that lends itself to that you see coming down the pike by any chance?
You know, I could probably speculate on, you know, problems that are coming down the pike that might require us to adapt, but what I celebrate every day is the judges and the non-judicial staff that work in this court system. They really do get charged up about their opportunity to adapt what they do to the changing societal needs. And what you point out is absolutely correct. When we realize that we have a lot of veterans returning from service in the 90s and the 2000s in Afghanistan and Iraq, one of the major issues is PTSD. PTSD manifests itself in substance abuse, sometimes in, you know, low-level inter-family or intra-family stress and violence. The court system saw that and said, you know, we don't want to break up these families. We don't want to throw away this veteran who served his or her country. Let's see if we can use the criminal charge that's pending against them as sort of a little bit of gentle leverage to get them to get the help and the treatment they need. And by the way, we're going to help open those doors for you. Mm-hmm. And when you get that help and treatment and you comply with it and you get your life back in order, then we can lessen the impact of those criminal charges. There certainly will be, as time evolves and as the economy fluctuates, there will be other issues that will come across the horizon. And what the public needs to know is that their court system is always looking at those issues and always being creative as to how we can use whatever influence we have over the lives of people to try to positively direct the situation.
I have heard that there is some concern among the prosecution side that the new bail reforms might make it more difficult to hold somebody or keep control of somebody for a couple of days while they can try to set up some sort of treatment. Do you have a fear or concern about that also, that could be an unfortunate result of it, that maybe not enormous?
Absolutely.
But there might be a few people who otherwise they'd be in jail for a couple of days while you can arrange for a bed at a treatment.
Absolutely.
Facility.
Absolutely. So what that says to me is that we have to find other creative ways to incentivize that defendant's participation in treatment. If you have a defendant who's in the throes of a heroin addiction, and when they are encountered by a police officer, and under the new law, that police officer doesn't take them into custody but writes them an appearance ticket, I think it's incumbent upon all of us who want to try to save that person's life to figure out creative ways that we can get that person in the door, have them assessed as quickly as possible, and help them get to, you know, in the first instance, a place where they can be detoxed and become free, get their system clean, mm-hmm. and then help them leave that place and get into another place that will help keep them clean. We have to keep trying to do that. We have to be creative. And I had a meeting earlier today with my supervising judges of the treatment courts, talking about how we can do that, how we can creatively change our approach, because we won't have them in custody anymore. So we got to find other ways to incentivize that defendant's participation. We always have the leverage of those criminal charges. And if we can work with the prosecution and the defense, which we have a wonderful relationship with, particularly on these issues, because everybody's got their role in the traditional criminal justice system, which is an adversarial system. But as you saw the other day when we announced the expansion of our human trafficking court, when it comes to trying to save someone's life or put somebody in a better place, this community is always willing to, I won't say put aside the traditional role, but view that role as a companion to how do we all put our heads together and help the person. And we're going to find some creative ways to do that. The bail reform makes it challenging because we won't have them in custody anymore. But that doesn't mean we can't find another way to help the individual.
Well, I was asking you about, you know, the creation of these special courts and so forth. But to some extent, you're able to do that kind of thing without actually sort of formalizing. And I've noticed that there's certain judges that end up being assigned to certain types of cases more than others. And there's, you don't really create a special court or a new court or anything like that, maybe because the volume just isn't there. But on the other hand, you have enough to warrant, because of the expertise required sometimes to have somebody in particular try to focus on those cases. So you have the freedom to do that.
Right? We do that frequently. I'll give you a recent example. We've had across the 7th Judicial District, there have been instances of folks filing actions that relate to the new legislation that eliminated the religious exemption for vaccinations. So that has resulted in litigation. Folks that would like to be able to make a choice for their children that they should not have a certain vaccine for whatever affliction we're talking about. So rather than have those cases assigned to 6 or 7 different judges, we're talking about having one judge who's developing, you know, a little bit of an expertise because they've had 1 or 2 of these cases, that will be the judge that will hear all these cases, because Supreme Court justices have jurisdiction. Really, they could preside over any case anywhere in the state, but those that are elected in the 7th District can preside over any case filed in any of our counties. We also did something similar, didn't create a separate part, but with cases filed under the new Child Victim Act.
Right.
We assigned Justices Schiano and Sinclair to be the local judges that will preside over those trials. Mm-hmm. Because those judges have been trained, they went through specialized training, they have a unique set of skills that will allow them to more efficiently handle those cases. We didn't create a specialized part for that.
Right.
We just assigned those cases to a smaller number of judges.
Last thing I want to ask you, just our conversation here probably explains a lot of, or shows a lot of people what you do, but still I want to ask you, tell people what you do. What does the administrative judge for the 7th Judicial District do? What's your responsibility and what kind of day-to-day, tasks do you have?
Sure. So I'm elected as a state Supreme Court justice. In that capacity, I preside over primarily criminal cases and civil cases. Part of my job is to be a judge and preside over real cases.
Right.
The other part of my job, which was given to me by the chief judge back in 2011, is to be the chief supervising judge of all the courts in the 7th Judicial District, which is 8 counties. And by all the courts, we mean somewhere in the neighborhood of about 330 judges and about 550 non-judicial employees.
Which gives us an idea of the inefficiency of the system.
In the courts of the 8 counties, yeah. I happen to think we're very efficient, Ben.
Well, not maybe not inefficiency.
If you compare our if you compare us on a number of measures to other courts in the state, you'll see that we have much reason to be proud in the 7th District.
I'm sorry, I meant to.
That's okay. I get what you're saying. Large bureaucracy, large, we're the third branch of government,
yeah.
If you think about it. We're, you've got the executive, you've got the legislative, and we're the judicial branch. So we have to be open every day. We have to be ready to receive cases. The Constitution doesn't allow us to have a sick day. We've got to be prepared. The courthouses have to be open, and we need to provide people a place to have disputes that we can't even anticipate what they're going to look like. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could imagine the diversity of issues that come into the court system, and the judges who are staffing these courts and the non-judicial staff, they got to be ready every day at those counters to take whatever comes in that door. And even your wildest imagination couldn't imagine what we have coming in the door. So my job is to oversee the operation of those courts and and I have amazing people that help me in that role. And it's a challenge, but it's also, you know, the honor of a lifetime to be able to be in a role like this, because every morning when I get up, you know, I get to think about how to creatively solve problems, how to utilize, as I've said a couple of times, the influence that the court system has over the lives of people to do a lot of the things that other people only get to talk about. In the court system, you know, every day we have an opportunity to actually really deliver positive things for people. So it's a big job, but it's one that I value.
Great. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for giving me a chance to brag about the court system. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
This has been the RBJ BizCast, the weekly podcast of the Rochester Business Journal. Until next week, visit us online at rbj.net and check out our sister publication, the New York Daily Record, at nydailyrecord.com. We're on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter at rbjdaily and at nydailyrecord. You can send questions, comments, and suggestions to blouden@bridgetowermedia.com. That's BLOUDON@bridgetowermedia.com. Thanks for listening.